I should tell you, though, that Callahan is hell-bent on throwing your ass in jail when she catches you.
It's been tried before, Clark said.
Far in the distance, a set of headlights arced through the night as a lone vehicle drove along the narrow farm-to-market road. Anyway, Caruso said, we'll see what forensics finds, but I'm not hopeful. All the bad guys are lawyering up as fast as we arrest them. We're running out of leads. The oncoming vehicle slowed and turned up the narrow two-track that led to the empty airstream.
Sit tight, Clark said. I may have more information for you shortly.
Caruso started to say something else, but Clark ended the call and began to work his way down the hill. Chapter 50. The man who arrived at the airstream that was tucked back among the oak trees was at least 60, and probably a little older. Clark was less than 50 feet away, watching from behind the doghouse, lying on his belly yet again. He looked at the photo of Ernie Pacheco that Caruso had sent him, and guessed this guy to be his father. Pacheco Sr. didn't even go inside the trailer. Instead, he grabbed a shovel that was leaning against the makeshift wooden porch and headed for the chicken coop. Ducking down through a small doorway, he disappeared inside with the shovel, then came out a short time later carrying not only the shovel, but also a large black duffel, and got in his truck and drove away. Travel cash, Clark thought. All his compatriots dropping dead around him had rattled his cage. He needed money to run, and he'd sent his daddy to get it for him. Clark jogged around the base of the hill to his rental car, reaching it about the same time he saw the lights of Pacheco Sr.'s pickup turn back onto the farm-to-market road. Clark stayed well back, following with his lights off and keeping his foot off the brakes until the pickup got on the highway. Traffic was light, but at least there were other cars on the road, making it far easier to tail. He didn't have to go far. 20 minutes after he'd left the chicken coop, the pickup pulled up in front of a white stone house in a rural neighborhood of 5- and 10-acre ranchettes on the outskirts of the small community of Glen Rose, about 50 miles southwest of Fort Worth. Clark killed his lights and watched from two lots up. He wished he'd brought some NVGs, but a nearby streetlight, out front of Pacheco's place, gave him just enough light to make out what was happening. Pacheco Sr. didn't seem all that thrilled about being a bagman. He cast worried glances over his shoulder when he got out of the truck, the kind of looks people use to bleed off nervous energy. But he didn't really see anything. A shadowed figure opened the door and then stepped out on the porch.
Hello, Ernie, Clark whispered.
He'd stopped thinking of this idiot as Matarife. It imbued him with too much worth if he had a spooky nickname. The old man all but threw the duffel bag at him and turned to go. Ernie looked like he might follow him back to the pickup, but he raised his hands in surrender and took the bag back inside.
Not the reunion you were hoping for, Clark said, an idea forming in his mind.
The pickup turned back onto the main road at the same time Clark pulled down the short drive to the white stone house. He parked his rental on the far left of the driveway, making it more difficult for Ernie to see it unless he came outside. He moved quickly, hoping to take advantage of the old man's recent departure, banking on Ernie thinking his dad had forgotten something and returned, maybe even to say goodbye. There was no peephole, just a floor-to-ceiling window to the right of the door. Clark stayed to the left, out of the line of sight. He beat on the door with the flat of his hand, not too hard, but like someone who knew the occupant had just walked inside. Pacheco opened the door a half-second later. Police tasers deliver a 50,000-volt shock for a 5-second duration. Clark shot Pacheco with a civilian model called a Bolt that gave him a 30-second ride. The instant he pulled the trigger, a compressed nitrogen canister propelled two barbed steel darts from the nose of the device on coils of whisker-thin wire. Deploying at an angle, one dart struck Pacheco just over his left nipple and the other in the center of his right thigh. The device chattered as it discharged electricity. Pacheco came up on his toes, arms rigid, teeth clenched, and toppled backward on the tile entry like a felled tree. body arched on his heels and the back of his head. 30 seconds gave Clark plenty of time to duct tape Pacheco's wrists behind his back, using several turns of tape to connect his hands and feet, bending his knees almost up to his buttocks and effectively hogtying him. Next, Clark stuffed a wadded paper towel into the man's mouth and then covered that with a strip of tape before dumping him into the trunk of the rental car. 2 minutes later, Clark was driving north on Highway 144. Traffic was almost non-existent, and he reached his destination on the outskirts of Fort Worth in just under an hour. The rental car bounced as he turned off the main street into a deserted industrial park. Clark did his best to hit every pothole and bump, bringing a chorus of muffled cries from behind the back seat. He used a pair of bolt cutters to defeat the cheap padlock and pushed open the gate, closing it behind him after he'd driven through so as not to rouse the suspicions of any roving police or security patrols, though he doubted there would be any. This area didn't have anything worth stealing. Clark parked the rental beside a nondescript metal building, tucking it in behind row after row of bright red 55-gallon rubber bins full of old oil filters and other industrial waste. Whistling to himself, he got out and slammed the door, pausing a few seconds so his passenger could anticipate and worry about what was going to happen next. Clark stood off to the side as he opened the trunk. There was always a chance that Pacheco had wriggled free of his bonds. Still tied, he gazed up at Clark in the red glow of the taillights. His eyes sparkled with abject horror. "You scared?" Clark asked. Pacheco nodded emphatically. Clark gave him a wink. "Kiddo," he said, "you ain't seen nothing yet." He hauled the terrified man out of the trunk and dragged him by his feet along the gravel. It would do him good to watch the process as it progressed. Clark had never been here before. That would have left him at too great a risk of being recognized. He had, however, studied the place at length through the satellite images from Google Earth. He knew that the iron contraption the size of a train engine beside the tin building was an industrial incinerator. He also knew that the controls were located in a square blue box on the side of a steel chute where employees of the plant loaded refuse to be destroyed. What the Google images did not show was that a fire from the day before still glowed inside the belly of the incinerator, the thermometer on the box still reading 600 degrees. A placard above warned that temperatures should not drop below 1600 degrees when refuse was being burned. The company's website advertised its ability to destroy industrial and hospital waste at temperatures exceeding 1900 degrees. Clark studied the directions for a moment, surprised to see there was no lock or computer key code, just a simple on-off switch to start the flow of gas to the primary burners, and two buttons on either side of the box that needed to be depressed simultaneously. He turned the switch, then counted to three before pressing both buttons. On the ground at his feet, Pacheco gave a muffled cry behind the duct tape as the gas inside the chamber ignited with a hollow whoomph. "Hmm," Clark mused, loud enough for Pacheco to hear. "Works just like my grill at home." The chamber of the incinerator itself was a somewhat stubby cylindrical tank, approximately 10 feet long by 7 feet high. A large walk-in door was cut into the front, used for raking ash, replacing any of the foot-thick insulation, or loading refuse that was too large to fit into the rear chute. Secondary burners at the top of the chamber reached 1200 degrees, igniting unburned gases before they could escape through a 15-foot chimney. Clark waited for the reading on the control panel to reach 1,880 degrees, and then lifted the heavy metal lid on the 3x6-foot chute attached to the rear of the chamber. The rusty, coffin-like box was smeared with black oil and flecked with bits of fiberglass insulation and other trash. A trap door hung down in front of the firebox, telltale orange flames just visible around the edges of blackened metal. The face of a heavy steel ram was flush with the back end of the chute. A red plastic sign affixed to the box above the controls warned, "Use by unauthorized persons is prohibited." Clark looked down at his prisoner, and smiled. Don't pay any attention to that. I'm authorized. Pacheco was no lightweight, and it took some maneuvering for Clark to get the thrashing man up over the edge. Both men were sweating, albeit for different reasons, by the time Pacheco landed inside the chute with his feet toward the fire chamber and his head against the ram. He rolled and thrashed, trying in vain to gain some kind of footing that would allow him to escape from the narrow prison. As he was wearing only gym shorts and a t-shirt, his hairy legs and arms were covered in black oil and grime in a matter of moments. Clark leaned over the side, peering down into the greasy darkness. He caught the sudden odor of urine. That made sense. For an instant, he felt a pang of guilt, and then remembered the dead girls in the sorghum field, the snuff videos, and a child named Magdalena who was still somewhere out there, perhaps even dead already. He clapped his hands together. They say this can melt bone, he said, but I'd imagine they'll find a knuckle or two. Pacheco began to sob. Clark pushed the red button. Nothing happened, except for the muffled screams, thrashing, and more urine. Ah, Clark said, the lid needs to be closed. He reached toward the hinge and flipped a manual override that allowed the mechanism to operate with the lid open before hitting the red button again. This time, the heavy door at Pacheco's feet began to slide upward, metal squealing against metal. At the same time, the ram at his head pushed him toward the waiting flames. Pacheco tried to brace himself, but even if he hadn't been tied, the slippery steel box would have made that all but impossible. Clark pushed the button again, relieved that the hydraulic ram actually stopped. It occurred to him that he should have tested it beforehand. Okay, Ernie, he said. Here we go. I need information. You have information. It's a simple process. Pacheco nodded, seeing a possibility of survival for the first time. Clark continued. I should tell you, I'm not a patient man. I'm looking for Magdalena Rojas. You're going to tell me where she is. More nodding and some muffled grunts. Clark shrugged. Not good enough. I told you I wasn't patient, Ernie. He pushed the red button again, waiting for the door to get halfway up and the ram to begin its movement before pushing it again. Sorry about that, Clark said, ripping away the tape. Guess I do need to take this off so you can talk. Pacheco spat out the paper towel and let fly a string of Spanish curses, hyperventilating to the point that Clark thought he might vomit. Clark reached as if to push the button again.
Okay, okay, Pacheco said. I dropped her at Emilio's. She was good when I saw her last. I swear on my mother's grave.
I've probably seen your mother's grave, Clark mused. Zambrano, where do I find him? Pacheco gave him directions to the ranch Caruso and Callahan had already visited. Clark shook his head. He left his hand over the red button. Already tried there.
Hang on, Pacheco cried. He's got another place out in Palo Pinto County.
He rattled off the directions. And if he's not there?
If he's not at his other place, that's where he'll be, Pacheco said. Good luck getting to him, though. He's got a shitload of guards. Lily's guys. Emilio is a badass, but his woman. I ain't shitting you, man, she's the devil. And her guys ain't much better.
Triad? Clark asked. He'd been wondering where all the Sun Yeon goons were hiding. Pacheco nodded.
She keeps a dozen or more around all the time. Look, amigo, I told you what you wanted to know. Can you please untie me now? You're scaring the shit out of me. Know what I'm saying?
I'm not your amigo, Clark said, his voice hoarse and pointed. Let's say Magdalena's not with Zambrano. Where else would I look for her? Pacheco snorted.
What is it with bitchy little Magdalena? Did you bid on her? And if you did, how did you find me?
He studied Clark for a moment and then threw him a conspiratorial smile.
You wily bastard. I knew Lupe didn't know how to make that computer anonymous. You found me with the IP address, didn't you?
Clark nodded. How much did Zambrano bid?
12 grand, Pacheco scoffed. Can you believe that shit? Hey, come on, let me out, and I'll get you set up with somebody even better. If Magdalena's your type, I got a line on a couple young ones down in Reynosa.
Clark slammed his fist into the red button. The trap door rattled upward. The fire greeted them with a terrifying roar. A cyclone of orange and yellow whirled and danced inside the glowing chamber. At the other end of the chute, the ram slid into the battery with a resounding clunk. Pacheco drew himself into a ball, flipped sideways, bent his neck, doing everything he could to brace himself. Nothing he did would stop the unrelenting steel ram from pushing him toward the flames. Now free of the gag, he loosed a shattered scream. Surely the same kind of cry the countless young women he'd murdered had screamed before him. Clark lowered the heavy door to the sound of metallic thuds and hysterical, shrieking pleas. The frenzied howls grew more intense, drowning out the hydraulic hum of the ram, and then fell silent, leaving only the roar and pop of the flames. The slaughterer, Clark said, sliding in behind the wheel of his rental car. What a dumbass name. Chapter 51. The Hendley Associates Gulfstream touched down on Atlanta Hartsfield's runway 8 right at 9:34 a.m. Pilot in command Helen Reed made the short taxi to Signature Aviation FBO and brought her airplane to a stop on the FBO's ramp. She hung her light-speed Zulu headphones over the yoke and climbed out of her seat to go check on fuel. Chavez wanted a quick turn and burn, and it was Reed who would make that happen. The flight from Buenos Aires to Atlanta had been just over 9 hours, thanks to a decent tailwind. Unfortunately, they wouldn't be quite so lucky on the Atlanta to Tokyo portion of the trip. First, she'd have to take the time to grab more fuel in L.A., and the winds were on the nose, adding back any time they'd gained on the trip north, and then some. Reed liked the hell out of Domingo Chavez. He was a good guy with lofty goals and a commitment to mission that was beyond laudable. But no matter how important the mission, physical laws being, well, the law, Tokyo was a lot of miles and minutes away. Reed expected total time in the air to be almost 25 hours. She and Hicks were talented pilots, but no one wanted to fly with a pilot who'd been awake for 25 hours. To that end, Reed had made a call to her boss before they left Buenos Aires. To his credit, Jerry Hendley had two G-550 pilots waiting inside the FBO when they landed in Atlanta. Sonny Cobb and Rich Caudill both had thousands of hours in the Army's C-37B, the military version of the G-550. After the military, Cobb had flown for the U.S. Marshals Service's Justice Prisoner and Alien Transportation Division, and Caudill for the FBI's hostage rescue teams. Neither of the pilots was a stranger to campus operations, and they often provided relief and augmentation to Reed and Hicks. Reed gave each man a peck on the cheek and then went to hit the head inside the FBO, relieved that they'd made it to Atlanta so she didn't have to let Chavez down. 20 minutes later, Reed and Hicks were back aboard and snoozing in the forward seats across from Lizanne Robertson. The Signature ground crew pushed the Gulfstream back from the ramp with Cobb and Caudill in the cockpit for the Atlanta-Los Angeles leg. In the rear of the airplane, Ding had Gavin Beery on speaker. Any information on Chen's phone? The last activity was a ping off an antenna in Buenos Aires at 17:30 Argentine time. Shit, Chavez said. I saw him use his phone after that. That means he's already dumped the phone we know about. Well, Beery said, for whatever reason, he's gone dark. I don't like this, Jack said, feeling an uncomfortable gnawing at his gut. Maybe Yuki and her team will grab him, Adara said, if he uses one of the IDs Gavin found for him. Maybe, Jack said, but that's an awfully big if. Okay, Gav, Chavez said. We'll be wheels up from Atlanta in 5 minutes. I'll check in again when we get to L.A. if I haven't heard from you before then. Keep us informed if you get anything else. Chavez ended the call and then looked at the rest of his team. ETA Tokyo, 1 p.m. local. That gives us 13 hours to figure out how we're going to find this guy. Special Agent Olson was quick on the keyboard for a hunt-and-peck typist. Callahan actually used all her fingers, which made her fast, but Caruso was even faster. Both agents sat at the desks on either side of Callahan's, consulting small notepads as they typed. The old man had made it clear that Callahan and her people were to glue their asses to the chair until they'd completed their paperwork, even if it was the weekend. Dallas was a large field office, and normally the special agent in charge left the day-to-day oversight of investigations to the various squad supervisors. This case had drawn enough national attention for someone to drop Dominic Caruso on top of them. That had the old man feeling antsy, and when the old man felt antsy, he got down in the weeds. He focused his wrath on the supervisors, and they in turn made the lives of working agents like Callahan a living hell. She needed to be out doing interviews, finding the trafficked kids, not in the hangar doing reports. The FBI Form 302, or Record of a Witness Interview, got a lot of press, mostly from people who felt their words had been twisted by the time they got to court. From Callahan's point of view, it wasn't an exaggeration to say that the Bureau was fueled by the damned things. And paperwork in general. New agents learned quickly to plan on 3 hours of paperwork for every 1 hour in the field. So much for the intrepid gumshoe detective. Sometimes she felt like a typist with a Glock. The time spent on paperwork did, however, give her the opportunity to accomplish at least one little bit of actual detective work. She'd already filled Caruso's coffee mug 3 times, hoping that he'd get up and go to the bathroom. She'd seen him drop his cell phone into the pocket of his blazer, which now hung over the back of his chair. With any luck, the coffee would give him a morning push, and he'd have to spend a couple minutes in the bathroom. Olson had said 2 minutes would be better, but a minute might be enough. Finally, Caruso stopped typing and pushed back from the desk. It looked like he was going to grab his phone, but Callahan said, "You done? We need to get on the road." Caruso said he had 2 302s left, but that he would hurry, and scurried off to the bathroom in the back corner of the hangar. Callahan waited for the door to close, and then fished out the phone and passed it to Olson, who was waiting with a cord that he used to attach the phone to his laptop. "We should probably get a warrant for this," he said, working feverishly at the keyboard. "Don't let him shoot me if he comes out." "It takes at least a minute to pee," she said. "This is some serious government-level encryption," Olson said. "I'll try and clone it, but the rest will take some time." "Can you get call logs?" "Maybe." Olson detached the phone and handed it back to Callahan. "What exactly are you hoping to find?" 20 feet away, the toilet flushed behind the bathroom door. Callahan dropped Caruso's phone back into his jacket and flopped back down at her desk, feeling more than a little guilty. "Find me all the numbers he's called in the last 48 hours, she said, "specifically during the time we were making the arrests at Naldo Cantu's place. I'm really interested in any of his contacts that go by the name John." Clark took a short nap, parked among half a dozen Class A motorhomes in a Walmart parking lot in West Fort Worth. No one bothered him while he waited for the store to open, and he slept deeply, his activities of the past 6 hours notwithstanding. Purchasing a handgun in a state where he wasn't a resident posed a problem, so he'd have to make do with the Glock 19 and the Wilson Combat 45. It was, however, no problem at all to purchase extra magazines and ammunition. He wore a baseball cap against the dozens of security cameras inside the store and made sure to keep it pulled down over his eyes as he chatted with the young man behind the sporting goods counter. No one appeared to give a second thought to the old dude stocking up for a trip to the shooting range. He bought more ammunition, along with 3 extra magazines for the Glock 19 and 2 more for the Wilson, giving him 5 and 4 respectively, and a total loadout of 109 rounds carried on his person. He threw in a bottle of brake fluid, along with a couple energy bars and a 20-ounce bottle of water, name brand, with a heavy-duty container, not the generic stuff. He stopped by a swimming pool supply store for a bag of chlorine granules. The internet was rife with people using the stuff for purposes other than intended, but Clark was just another old dude buying shock treatment for his pool. He didn't get a second look. Loading magazines was a zen-like experience for him, and Clark took his time, thinking through his plan as he depressed the follower and slid in each successive round. He tucked the mags in the pocket of his navy blue windbreaker and stuffed the remainder of his gear into the Camelback hydration pack. He left the Gemtech suppressor attached to the Glock and put that in the pack as well, wearing the Wilson on his hip for the time being. In his pocket, he carried a small flashlight, a Zippo lighter, and a heavy-duty Benchmade automatic knife called a Presidio. He was not one to consider blades very good defensive weapons. They just weren't tactical. Offensive killing was an entirely different story. Clark spent the next 10 minutes sitting in the parking lot studying Google Maps of the area around Zambrano's place, committing the various possible routes of approach to memory. He'd look at them again when he got closer, but it gave his mind something to chew on while he made the hour-and-a-half drive. In the meantime, he pushed the speed dial button for his wife. She answered on the first ring. He had no news, at least none that he could share with her. Sometimes, it was just comforting to hear her voice. Emilio Zambrano had done Clark the great favor of building his house on a lake. People in the United States tended to feel more secure when they faced the water, as if any threat would have to work too hard to get to them from that direction. There were several lots for sale across this arm of the reservoir, and it was a simple matter for Clark to park and pretend to be an interested customer. He would eventually work his way closer, but a pair of 18-power marine binoculars from a quarter mile away helped him rough out the beginnings of a plan. Zambrano had gone a step further than most and picked a site in a secluded bay, cut back approximately 50 meters from the main body of the lake. The home itself was a gray brick two-story, tucked in at the head of the bay in between two limestone ridges that were covered with cedar trees. The eastern ridge jutted out farther than the one on the west and looked like it would make a good vantage point when he did decide to move closer. A long grassy hill, as manicured as any fairway at Augusta, ran down from a raised deck on the front of the house to the water's edge. A runabout, gleaming white in the Texas sun, was tied up to a set of floating docks. To the right of the house, a swimming pool had been cut into the side of the hill, along with a brick cabana that matched the house. The cabana, as well as a small utility shed partway down the hill, hid much of the pool from any boats that happened to venture too close to the property. For Clark's purposes, the outbuildings conveniently created a blind spot from above, leaving a good portion of the dock invisible from the upper portion of the property. Clark watched long enough to count 7 different men wandering the grounds. There was something going on up at the pool, but the angle was wrong, so he couldn't tell what it was. He took a swig of bottled water before pouring the remainder into the dirt and replacing it with about a half cup of brake fluid. He recapped the bottle and put it in the Camelback with the unopened sack of pool shock. After one final gear check, he drove to the other side of the lake. Clark had arrived early enough in the day that he could take his time. He drove past Zambrano's nondescript steel gate and left the rental in the trees nearly a mile down the gravel road. From there he traveled cross-country, going up and over 2 scrubby hills before arriving at the eastern ridge overlooking Zambrano's docks. His dark blue windbreaker and khaki slacks melded perfectly with the mottled shadows of scrub cedar and caliche rock. Clark often thought that he'd spent at least a quarter of his adult life flat on his belly, peering through one kind of scope or another, watching, waiting. There was, to him, a great virtue in stillness. His initial assessment had been correct. The ridge offered a near-perfect vantage point of the house, the expansive deck and hot tub, the pool, and the docks below. He was much closer than before, but at just over 100 meters and in the trees, was far enough away that he didn't have to worry too much about being seen. Still, years of discipline forced him to move slowly and deliberately, staying off the ridgeline to keep from silhouetting himself. Making himself comfortable, he set the binoculars on the ground beside him and took out the notebook and pencil again, entering data in more detail now that he was close enough for a better look. His first course of business was to identify as many of Zambrano's men as he could. From the looks of things, Pacheco had been right. Security here was the Sun Yeon Triad, likely employed by Lily Chen. It wasn't like the movies. The men did not wear any kind of uniform or patrol with open firearms that might draw attention from a passing bass boat or party barge. The man farthest down by the docks was carrying a fishing rod in his left hand, though he never used it to fish. His t-shirt was a size too small for his husky frame, making the imprint of a pistol easy to see if you looked for it. But that wouldn't draw any attention in Texas, particularly out here, where water moccasins and rattlesnakes were common encounters. Clark printed Muffin Top on the top line of a new page in his notebook. In a matter of 15 minutes, he'd written Pigeon, for the man's propensity to jut his neck out when he peered back and forth to look for threats. Richie Rich, because of his fancy gold watch that provided an eye-catching target. And Geezer, Rat Tail, and Sasquatch, all for obvious reasons. All of them were Asian, heavily tattooed, and apart from Muffin Top, they looked to be in reasonably good condition. Clark was beginning to think he'd miscounted when the seventh man walked out from under the deck. While the others on the security team kept their weapons hidden, this one carried a short CZ Scorpion SMG on a single-point sling around a thick neck. Short and blocky, he was nearly as wide as he was tall. Clark picked up his pencil again and scribbled another name in the notebook. I will call you Mini Fridge. Chapter 52. President Jack Ryan stepped across the corridor to the Roosevelt Room, where Dr. Miller was setting up shop on the long oak table. The White House never slept completely, even on the weekends, so there were still a few staffers pecking away at keyboards up and down the halls or compiling reports that had to be ready by Monday morning. Al Chadwick in the communications office came in every Sunday to watch the morning shows at his desk while his wife took the kids to church. Ryan carried 2 paper cups of coffee and the Saturday edition of the Wall Street Journal he'd never gotten around to reading. Miller shot to her feet when she saw him, but he gave her a friendly toss of his head and set both cups on the table. Relax, he said. You're the one giving up your weekend. Cream and sugar. Miller shook her head, stricken. I can't believe the President of the United States brought me coffee. I make terrible coffee, Ryan said. Lucky for you, I only had to open the spigot to get this stuff. He nodded to the 3 notebooks and multiple colored pencils with which the mathematician was taking notes. I don't want you to feel rushed, but I can reinstitute the draft if you want to recommend a few co-workers to come in and help you out. I'll be fine, Mr. President, Miller said. Frankly, my process is somewhat odd. Odd? Ryan said. He didn't intend to stay long, but sat down so Miller would follow suit. How so? Well, I don't mean to brag, she said, but I was born with a near-perfect photographic memory. It drives my boyfriend crazy. Ryan smiled, enjoying the young woman's forthrightness. Dr. Miller continued. You know those colorblind tests where you see a number or a letter among a bunch of squiggled, nonsensical globs? Ryan nodded. Well, if you were to show me a bunch of globs that formed an unintelligible half of a letter or number, and then an hour or even a day later showed me a bunch of globs with the corresponding half of that original letter or number, my brain would recall the first image and then superimpose the two, filling in the blanks and giving me the whole picture. Ryan said, here's to you filling in some blanks for us, then. I'll do my best, sir, Miller said. I'll be in the Oval Office for a few hours. He pointed to the phone at the end of the table. You can push this button if you have any questions. Tell the operator who you are, and she'll let me know. Miller stood again when he did. Sir, don't forget your cup of coffee. Oh, no, Ryan said. Those are both for you. I expect you'll need them. By 4 p.m., Clark had watched the Triad security men make their prescribed rounds three times. They appeared to have six assigned posts, with a seventh spot behind a small utility shed down the hill between the pool and the lake. There they'd stashed a folding camp chair out of sight of the main house and used it to rest their feet during periodic smoke breaks. Muffintop and Geezer both seemed to get winded just walking up the steep hill when they had to reach a post nearer the house. Clark noted that in the book by their respective names. There was movement in the house, and once, someone inside called out to the nearest security man to bring something inside from a truck parked out back. Clark had yet to see anyone who might be Magdalena Rojas, or for that matter, Emilio Zambrano or Lily Chen. They were here, though. No one had this kind of roving security just to guard an empty residence. Then, at almost exactly five straight up, the double doors on the second floor yawned open, and an Asian woman stepped out onto the deck. She wore a red one-piece swimsuit that fit her well and showed off long legs and an athletic body. Clark guessed her to be in her late 30s, maybe even 40. Her hair was short, shaved on one side, the front turned up in a high pompadour. A pair of large heart-shaped sunglasses covered much of her face. Even from a distance, Clark could see a haughtiness in her walk, chin up, one arm crooked out to the side, as though she were leading an invisible dog. Two girls followed her out like attendants, both dark, probably Hispanic, and wearing red swimsuits that matched the older woman's. The lead girl, Clark guessed her to be Magdalena Rojas, carried a rolled towel and a container of sunblock. A somewhat taller and heavier girl followed with a round tray loaded with two tall glasses and a bowl of popcorn. Each girl wore a wide strap around her left ankle. In any other situation, Clark might have thought they were decorative. He'd never understood the fashion of youth, even when he'd been young himself. But given the circumstances, the straps were more likely restraints. Neither girl looked to be older than 13. A well-muscled man with salt-and-pepper hair brought up the rear, pulling the doors shut behind him. Emilio Zambrano wore red board shorts and a white Hawaiian shirt, open in front to reveal a hairless chest draped in gold chains. Had it not been for the dazed looks on the faces of the girls, it would have been easy to mistake the foursome for a family out for a swim in matching suits. The girls followed a few steps behind Lily Chen, careful as they descended the stairs from the upper deck to the pool. Richie Rich, the Triad security man with the blingy watch, stepped into the cabana. The heavy bass beat of some rap song Clark didn't recognize, which wasn't saying much, began to thrum from speakers around the pool. Clark smiled inside. "Well, that's helpful," he whispered. He was gratified to see that all the security men turned to look inward at the sound of the music, when the more practical thing to do would have been to face outward. Either the Triad guys weren't very well trained, or they considered Zambrano and Chen to be more dangerous than anything that might possibly attack their position from the outside. Clark scribbled a couple more notes in his book, a barked command from Zambrano to one of the Asian guards. Rat tail, from the looks of it, caused the heavier of the two girls to drop her tray. The glasses crashed onto the concrete walk beside the pool. Lily turned slowly, lowering her big sunglasses to glare down at both cowering girls. Zambrano cuffed the tall girl in the back of her head, shouting something Clark couldn't quite make out. The girl fell, wilting from the blow, and began to pile the broken glass on the tray. Magdalena set the towel and sunscreen on the ground and stooped to help. Cursing now, Zambrano walked to the edge of the pool next to the diving board and then turned to give the girl a swift kick in the thigh. She'd apparently gotten glass in the pool. Chen pointed at the water. The girl stood slowly, glancing at the pool, then shaking her head. Chen nodded, smiling and continuing to point at the water. The girl shook her head again. It was obvious that Chen was telling her to go retrieve any broken glass, and it was just as obvious that the girl was terrified to get into the water. Chen grabbed the girl by the hair and dragged her in, shoving her over the side. The poor girl sputtered and kicked, but after her initial panic, was able to stay afloat by dog paddling. There were no markings on the edge, but the diving board said it was at least 8 feet on that end. Lily Chen continued to point, shoving the crying child away with her bare foot each time she made it to the edge. By now, Rat Tail, Muffin Top, and Mini Fridge had all gathered around the pool to watch the fun. Muffin Top laughed, but a glare from Lily sent him hustling back down the hill to his post at the docks. Chen pantomimed holding her nose and diving, but the girl was too panicked to pay attention to any directions. She could barely keep her head above water. Magdalena approached with her head down, staring at the ground. She said something to Chen, who gave a flick of her hand and turned away. Magdalena jumped in immediately, helping her friend to the edge of the pool and then turning to dive to the bottom, surfacing a moment later with the jagged bottom of a broken glass. She climbed out of the pool and set the glass on the tray, offering to carry it back inside. Instead, Lily snapped her fingers and Rat Tail took care of it, trotting dutifully up the steps to the deck and disappearing into the house. Clark wrote Pool Boy beside Rat Tail's name in the notebook. When he looked up, Zambrano had attached a short leash from a metal deck chair to the taller girl's ankle. There was a similar leash on another chair, probably meant for Magdalena, but she was busy rubbing sunscreen on Lily Chen's shoulders. The Chinese woman said something to Zambrano, who shrugged, and then dragged the deck chair, along with the attached girl, to the edge of the deep end. He pointed in again, as if telling her there was still more glass at the bottom from her accident, and then he kicked the chair over the edge. The heavy chair jerked her under mid-scream. Clark's heart leapt into his throat. His hands clawed at the dirt beside him. There was no way he'd be able to cover the distance from his hide to the pool in time to save her, even if he wouldn't have been cut down by gunfire. He could start shooting, but at nearly 100 meters away, he'd be hard-pressed to make pistol shots effective. Shots would only send everyone running for cover, leaving the girl to drown. No. His only hope was to bank on the fact that Zambrano had likely bid a great deal of money on both girls, and would not want to kill off his investment. Half a minute in, Zambrano gave Magdalena a nod. The skinny little Costa Rican sprang forward at once, diving in to save her friend. Zambrano stood on the edge with Mini Fridge, watching in amusement. When the chair proved too heavy even for Magdalena to keep afloat, Zambrano begrudgingly hooked his thumb at the water, and the short Chinese man handed off his SMG to dive in. The taller girl gagged when Zambrano dragged her out, vomiting on the concrete pool deck. Lily Chen could not be bothered to look up from her magazine during the entire ordeal. Clark focused on his breathing, having to work hard to relax his jaw. His original plan had been to wait until sundown, but he wasn't about to stand by and watch something like that again. He took one last scan with the binoculars. The Sun Yion guys had just rotated posts, so he could count on them being in roughly the same position for the next half hour. He carried both pistols and all his magazines on his belt, keeping the Glock mags from 9 o'clock over his left hip and forward. The Wilson 45 mags he kept from 9 o'clock rearward toward the small of his back, but still within reach. The Presidio was in his left pocket. He could have solved this whole problem with a rifle. Any warfighter worth his salt knew that if you ever had to pull a handgun during a fight, you were in deep shit. But pistols were better than fists and feet. Clark had always been breakable. Everyone was, though he hadn't admitted it as a younger man. He just didn't heal quite as quickly anymore. That, along with the lack of a long gun, couldn't be helped. And anyway, he'd decided to play the hand he was dealt early on in this game. He ran through the plan again in his head, drawing a circle around his sketch of the docks. "Well, Muffin Top," he whispered, "looks like you get to be first." It was not at all uncommon for President Ryan to work through lunch and dinner when he was focused on something. The G20 was looming, and there were dozens of topics, economic and otherwise, that he needed to bone up on before he left for Japan the next morning. With Kathy out of town and no one from the scheduling office ramrodding him through endless appointments, he was able to get through half the stack. It was almost 6 by the time he came up for air. "I apologize," he said after he'd stepped out of the oval and across the corridor into the Roosevelt room. "I didn't mean to abandon you." Dr. Miller stood again. "Al from communications brought me a chicken wrap." "Good," Ryan said, eyeing the open notebooks beside Miller's laptop. "Anything interesting?" "I think I'm about done," she said. Ryan shook his head. "I don't want you to feel as though you have a deadline, Dr. Miller. This is important, and I fully realize it takes time." "Frankly," Miller said, "I wish I could say I needed more time. This place is amazing compared to my office. Anyway, I found the initial financial ties between China and the bank in Africa the old-fashioned way, by analyzing computer data. I figured I could broaden my focus after you pointed me in the right direction. Once I had an idea of what to look for, I was sure all the blobs I told you about would become crystal clear, as long as I did enough snooping." "And what did you find out?" "Well," Miller said, "entities that appear to represent the government of China, and even President Zhou Chongji himself, have assets in Africa, Bali, and Paraguay. There's a Balinese company which appears to be a shell business for Zhou with ties to Jemaah Islamiyah. They're tenuous, but they are there." Ryan sat in a chair across the table and leaned back, thinking. "I don't understand," he said. "There are so many methods to stay under the financial radar. Cryptocurrencies, cutouts, middlemen, and offshore banking. Why would anyone conduct business this way if they wanted to hide it?" "That's the thing, Mr. President," Dr. Miller said. "I wish I could tell you that my amazing photographic memory cracked this case for you, sir. To be honest, I might have done it a little more quickly than others could have. But any good forensic accountant would have found these connections once they knew where to look. If someone was trying to hide these transactions, they didn't do a very good job of it." Chapter 53. Dave Holloway, skipper of the Defense Intelligence Agency's research vessel Meriwether, was a civilian now, but his time in the Navy had taught him to believe in the rule of threes. Three bad events or circumstances, no matter how seemingly minor or unrelated, warranted a hard look at declaring a no-go. Strike one, his crew was green. But for himself, the navigator, and the mechanic, the 10 souls on board were scientists, not sailors. Only 5 had even minimal experience on blue water. Strike two, the maintenance records for the converted 89-foot fishing trawler left much to be desired. Oh, the boat ran all right, and the logs showed no recent problems, but maintenance issues had a way of rearing their heads in the darkest parts of the sea. Strike three, his bosses at the Joint Functional Component Command for Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance were in too much of a hurry. There were times to rush, but launching a boat with a new crew and poor records was not one of those times. The guys at JFCC-ISR praised his seamanship, played up the talents of his crew and the beauty of the little boat. He'd returned their cajoling with Warren Buffett's sentiment that no matter how great the talent or efforts, some things just take time. You can't produce a baby in 1 month by getting 9 women pregnant. He wanted a month to assure himself that the boat and the crew were ready, but the folks at Anacostia gave him 3 days. They did not believe in the rule of threes. At 53, Holloway was a fourth-generation sailor, and as such, he knew how to follow orders. If the bosses said go, he noted his concerns in the log, and then gave a sharp, "Aye, aye, sir," before going. The typhoon worried him at first, but it had turned northward, leaving Holloway and his little boat to their duties of gathering signals intelligence from any PRC or DPRK subs plying the waters of the East China Sea. Masquerading as a fishing research vessel, Meriwether ran a zigzagging surveillance run out of Naha, heading for Taipei to refuel before making the return trip back to Okinawa. It should have been a straightforward mission, but now the storm track had changed again. "I don't like the look of this," his navigator, a nautical engineer named Rocky Bell, said, tapping the radar screen on the console at the helm. She was sharp, a graduate of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, and one of the few real sailors on the boat. "I know," Holloway said. "Damn thing's moving west again. We can duck into Keelung City on the north end of Taiwan if need be." He nodded to the forecastle. "I'll be out on deck a moment." Holloway left the pilot house through the side door and made his way forward. Instruments were all well and good, but he preferred to look at the waves and sky for important information. He didn't particularly like what he saw. The muggy air was clear above, but a line of black clouds to the east made him clench his teeth. The sea was already heaping up, and a stiff wind blew at least 30 knots, carrying with it the heavy smell of rain and ripping foam and spray off honest 8-foot waves. Holloway turned to walk back inside, but a sudden jolt, like an earthquake rippling along the deck, nearly threw him off his feet. He looked through the pilot house window at Rocky, who shrugged. "A rogue wave, maybe?" Holloway felt Meriwether shift under him as the stern swung around, broadside to the wind. They were slowing. Stumbling back inside on the rolling deck, Holloway glared at his navigator. "What the hell just happened?" "I'm trying to raise engineering now," she said, microphone in hand. She tapped the instrument panel on the console. "Engine temperatures are through the roof." The fire klaxon sounded a half second later, followed by the voice of Don Patton, the 26-year-old ship's mechanic, halting and breathless. "Scavenge fire in the diesel. Crankcase explosion," Patton said. "Steam it out," Holloway ordered. "I've done that, Skipper," the mechanic said. "Fire's under control." "Are you hurt?" "A few burns," Patton said, "but not as bad as the diesel." "How long until you can get her running again?" Holloway asked. There was a long pause as Meriwether swung around, broadside to the gale, at the mercy of the approaching storm. "I'm not sure it's even..." Holloway cut him off. He didn't want fatalistic talk. "Give me an estimate." "I'll do my best, Skipper," Patton said. "That's all I can ask, son," Holloway said, "so long as you understand that we're about to get a very uncomfortable saltwater enema if this typhoon hits us while we have no power." "Aye, sir," the mechanic said. "I'll send Rocky down to see to your burns." He nodded to the navigator, who was already grabbing the medic bag from under the console. Holloway took a deep breath, cursing at his own stupidity. He'd taken out a green crew on a ship he didn't quite trust. It didn't matter how much the suits back in Anacostia had wanted him to hurry. He knew better. DIA wasn't to blame for this. He couldn't even blame the previous mechanic for faulty diesel maintenance, though that was surely the cause. The little spy ship groaned, turning again before the wind, wallowing in the middle of a vast and unfriendly ocean. There was a lot of tech on board that the Chinese Navy would just love to get their grimy hands on, if the typhoon didn't sink her first. Whatever happened, the blame rested squarely on Holloway's shoulders. He was the skipper, and he'd disregarded his rule of threes. Clark estimated it would take him less than a minute to cover the 40 meters to the dock. Most people who tried to swim that far underwater ended up flailing around and wasting energy trying to go too fast for fear of running out of breath. Clark would swim at a walking pace, gliding rather than powering through, because if you fought the water, you always lost. Holding his breath wouldn't be an issue. Staying on course in the chocolate-brown lake water would be the challenge. That, and timing his arrival some muffintop was facing the other direction. The heavy beat of rap music was still rolling down the grassy hill when Clark made it to the bottom of the Finger Ridge east of Zambrano's. He kept low, on the far side of the hill and out of sight. Hours of surveillance had shown him that each of the triad sentries had his own method of patrol. Muffintop spent a great deal of time gathering skipping stones on the shore, in between sauntering out the 20 feet or so of pier to walk back and forth a few times on the floating tee where the boat was tied. The boat occupied most of the western arm, which made it more difficult to skip stones. Consequently, the chubby sentry spent a hair more time on the easternmost 10 feet of floating dock, a fact that Clark intended to exploit. He entered the water silently, wearing the camelback and all his gear. The slow, deliberate movements came as second nature to him, and he was up to his chin in no time without creating even the slightest splash. He ducked his head under once, wetting his hair and face while he took the time to get a feel for the rocky bottom under his boots. In the Navy, they'd almost always had a swim buddy, especially in the perilous world of the SEALs. The hazards of going it alone underwater were well documented, but the real world was a brutal place. Taking 3 deep breaths to saturate his lungs with oxygen, he worked his way around the point, slowly cutting the pie to bring the docks into view. Muffin Top was on the shore, his back turned, picking up stones. Anyone who hadn't done their homework might think now was the time to go. But Clark didn't need the man with his back turned now. He needed him with his back turned in 40 seconds. The chubby sentry turned with his hands full of rocks. The second his lead foot hit the pier, Clark ducked beneath the surface and began his swim. The poor visibility that made navigation difficult also saved Clark from getting shot as he swam. Even so, he stayed as deep as possible, skimming just inches above the rocky bottom. He concentrated on keeping his strokes and kicks even, making certain to go in a straight line. 40 seconds later, he slipped under the darkness of the dock. It was relatively shallow, and he was able to stand with his head above water. Long shafts of light showed through the wooden treads above styrofoam floats. Muffin Top hummed softly at the other end of the dock, pitching stones one by one. This was the point where things grew difficult. Sentries were human beings, enemy or not. They were somebody's kid, somebody's brother, uncle, or husband. Some of them sang and skipped rocks. But Muffin Top wasn't just a security guard who happened to be working for the wrong guy. He was Sun Yi on Triad, complicit in the slavery of at least the 2 girls up by the pool. He'd laughed his fat ass off when one of those girls had almost drowned. No, he could sing like Pavarotti for all Clark cared. That didn't give him a soul. Wood creaked and swayed as Muffin Top walked to the east end of the dock. Waiting at the far end, just outside the edge, Clark brought the Glock up a fraction of a second after his face broke the surface, tipping the barrel slightly to let the water drain. The shot struck Muffin Top as he threw his first stone, straight through the bottom of his chin. The Triad man teetered there for a moment, the rest of his rocks slipping from his hand, and then fell face first toward the water. Clark rounded his shoulders, collapsing under the weight of Muffin Top's body, mitigating the splash. Ready to duck and swim, he glanced uphill and breathed a sigh of measured relief that no one came running down with guns blazing. Clark stuffed Muffin Top's body under the edge of the dock, and then, without looking back, swam past the boat to exit the water at the other end of the cove. He moved quickly, up the long finger ridge that ran along the west side of the house, opposite his earlier vantage point. He had about 10 minutes until the guards shifted posts, if he was lucky. It took him 5 minutes to work around to the circular driveway behind the house. He would have put a guard up here by the vehicles, but was glad Zambrano and Shen relied on a man in the trees 100 meters away up by the gate. Clark hadn't actually seen this one's face. Just enough movement when he'd driven by to know someone was there. The gate guy was too far away to be an immediate threat, but Clark would have to remember to watch his 6 once the rodeo began. Clark shrugged off the camelback in the relative safety of the cedar trees along the driveway. Music still thumped around the corner, muted some by the house. The sun was low, and though it was still plenty light, would soon fall behind the ridge, throwing the little valley into shade. There was a strong possibility Zambrano and Shen would go back in the house when that happened, which put more pressure on Clark. He wanted them outside to make this work. The half cup of chlorine granules dumped in the water bottle of brake fluid gave him about 1.5 minutes. He didn't bother with the lid, but left the bottle upright beneath the gas tank. The mixture did nothing at first. Clark punched a hole in the rear of the gas tank with his Benchmade, large enough that fuel began to drain into the gravel beside the water bottle. This done, he rolled out from under the truck to crawfish back into the buckbrush along the driveway, well away from what he knew was